Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
It's time for part two of our exclusive interview with Goran Ivanišević, and yes, it has a happy ending. Well, let's be honest, he'd lost three Wimbledon finals, so it's not like he didn't deserve it, although he didn't quite know it would happen like this. We'll also talk Heather Watson, Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic, and Roger Federer right here on the Tennis Podcast. Well, hello. I'm talking very, very quietly this week because I'm trying not to sound too full of myself as a British person presenting a tennis podcast at a time when we've just had our first female singles title winner in 24 years. Oh yes, Heather Watson, just a couple of weeks after Laura Robson reached the final in Guangzhou, just a month after Andy Murray won the US Open, in the same week as Johnny Murray qualified for the O2 ATP World Tour Finals. We have a British winner yet again, Catherine Whittaker. Welcome to the Tennis Podcast. I am absolutely ecstatic. How are you?
It's a good time to be British, isn't it? I'm very well, thanks.
Yes. Can you hear all of those iPods and iPads and iPhones and computers from around the rest of the world just clicking off this Tennis Podcast at the moment as we revel in our British victory yet again?
Those are all annoying. People in countries that have plenty of opportunity to be smug. You know, we just don't know when opportunity's next going to come
around.
This
is
all about maximising while you have the chance.
Yeah, this is our time to revel a bit, isn't it? But no, all joking aside, and I'll try not to be too smug for the rest of the podcast, because I accept that it's only two British women, and they're number 50 and number 52 in the rankings respectively, are Heather Watson and Laura Robson. But these are heady days for us here in Great Britain, and Heather Watson actually did a press conference back in the UK a couple of days ago, or it was yesterday, wasn't it, after she'd managed to win that title in Osaka, and there was huge interest. I mean, I noticed all of the national television stations here, BBC, ITV, Channel 4 News, Channel 5 News, they were all there, Sky Sports, they were all there to speak to Heather Watson, and just can't get enough of her at the moment.
She's such a personable girl, isn't she? She's somebody that the public can really get involved in. People, you just wish her well, don't you? You want good things for her. You feel like you're able to share in her success because she's so smiley and she's so she just seems like a great girl, doesn't she? I mean,
yeah, well, she is. Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what she is. I interviewed her just on the eve of the US Open this year. It was either the same day or the day after she'd won the doubles title, I think in New Haven the week before. And she came in to the US Open, you know, she'd not had time to think about anything, you know, she hadn't had, you know, it was the day before the tournament's starting, and here she was, you know, trying to get ready for her first round match, and she was quite happy to speak to anybody who needed to speak to her. She turned up with a smile on her face, she sat down and was quite happy to chat and spend as long as we needed, and it's refreshing, to be honest. And I would say that there are more players like that these days. I think players do get it more, and she certainly does. But it's very,
right,
very pleasing.
But I think also what's so wonderful about her is that it all seems very natural, doesn't it? It doesn't seem like she's putting on an act and is conscious of needing to be, you know, needing to be friends with the media and everything. She just seems to be very natural with it all, to just be a very likable girl and to have a good head on her shoulders, yeah. Which is obviously going to serve her.
I think that's true. And I remember the first time I met her was in Australia, I think about 4 years ago, something like that, when she'd when I first saw her name on the junior list, and I think she got through to about the semi-finals, and she won one match when her opponent was cramping horribly and in just brutally hot conditions, and there was something right there. And then you thought, actually, this girl has the sort of attitude and constitution and no little skill as well. I mean, she's a good mover, a good baseliner. I don't think she has a killer shot, but she certainly has a lot of the attributes that can take her quite a long way in the game.
Yes, and I think that's, I mean, I don't want to take anything away from it, but let's not get too carried away with the tournament victory. You know, I think in some ways it was a victory in scheduling as well. You know, that was a perfect tournament for her to play. The highest seed in there was Sam Stosur, and she had a really disappointing run there. The highest seed that Heather had to beat to win that tournament was Anabel Medina Garrigues, who's around about 40 in the world, and, you know, still a great result. But I think what it's most significant for is her confidence, especially with the manner that she won third set tiebreak. I think it's incredibly significant from a mental standpoint for her. You know, I don't think we should now be saying, oh, well, she's a world beater, because so far she hasn't beaten anybody at the top. So I don't think
it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because, you know, there were a range of different sort of newspaper headlines the day after her press conference to celebrate this win and to sort of review the year. And of course, she has met her goal. She's in the top 15 now. She wants to go higher. But I mean, there were some headlines I read virtually quoting her as saying, I can be the world number one. And I think what had actually happened is one of our colleagues had asked her, do you believe that you are capable of one day being the world number one? And as Simon Briggs in the Telegraph said today, it's kind of an impossible question to answer in a way that is not going to get you in trouble, because if you say, well, yes, I do think I can be world number one, suddenly you've got those headlines and that expectation. If you say, well, no, I don't think I can be world number one, then you sound as though you're setting your bar too low. So,
but she's a very ambitious, very competitive 20-year-old girl. I think she has to believe that it's a possibility, remote as it may be. You know, she has to believe that in all the infinite ways that her career could turn out, one of them could be that she'll end up as, you know, I think it's important that she believes that, whether it's realistic or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't put restrictions on yourself.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and actually I would say as well, I think it's a perfectly legitimate question to ask a player. Okay, it's a little bit of a hospital pass in a way, as I've mentioned there, because you do get those headlines. But I think that most people realise that she's an ambitious player, and she will go as far as she possibly can in the game, and she will stop pretty much at nothing within fair means in order to get as high as she can possibly become. And I think that's really all you can ask of any player.
Yeah, I mean, she moved to Florida, what, at the age of 12, 13? She's already shown, you know, that she's not afraid of making sacrifices for her career, is she? I mean, that's a pretty major sacrifice to have to make at such a young age. So
Says a lot, Catherine, as well, that it was Heather Watson on Monday morning grabbing the headlines. I noticed Neil Harmon in The Times, who we featured on the Tennis Podcast a few weeks ago, I think, wrote three different stories about it with all different sorts of angles. And really, Andy Murray, despite having played a sensational match against Novak Djokovic, which Djokovic eventually won in the final there in Shanghai, that was really relegated as to the supplementary story, wasn't it?
Yes, which is interesting. It made me wonder whether if Murray hadn't, now that he's a Grand Slam champion, we can be a bit more, not certainly not dismissive, I don't want to say that, but you know, we can be a bit more,
we can be a bit more blasé,
a bit more blasé, you know. These winning a Masters Series title for Murray isn't life or death as good as it gets anymore, you know.
Now in Britain, now that we're getting a winner every other week, you know, we can just sort of brush it off, yeah, as the norm,
Masters,
can't we, Catherine?
Small fry, yeah, exactly.
No, let's be honest, we're enjoying it, and we've had enough years of barely having players to report on and so forth and talk about in a way that we would want, and these are enjoyable times, it was a great week. But that was some match, wasn't it, between Djokovic and Murray? I mean, that was one of the most brutal three set matches I think I've seen.
It was absolutely sensational, and another point sort of following on from what I just said there is that not only will the British media not quite dissecting it and analysing it in the way that they perhaps would have done before he won the US Open, I don't think Andy Murray himself will be overanalyzing a defeat like that in the way he would have done a couple of months ago. Do you agree on that?
No, I think you're right. I do. And I think the biggest difference I've noticed in Murray since the US Open is that he seems to be looking at one match at a time, and it's the horrible old cliche of one match at a time. And yet I actually think probably for the first time in his career, he really feels able to do that, because the pressure of will I ever win a Grand Slam has gone. He's done it. And now he can just get back to the nuts and bolts of training, of winning tennis matches. And frankly, if anybody asks him a question like that now, he just has to show them his trophy. He doesn't have to worry about it anymore. I think the only outstanding question, I mean, I suppose there are still outstanding questions. Will he ever get to world number one? Will he be able to win another Grand Slam? I always remember Pat Rafter getting branded a one-slam wonder at one stage in his career. And obviously he went on and won another one. But, you know, players do get that sort of tag. I mean, Michael Stich, another one who's had that, and you know,
Richard
cracking
Krajicek,
player.
Yeah.
He was, Richard Krajicek, you mentioned. And I suppose until Andy Murray wins Wimbledon, there'll always be a big asterisk next to his name as one of the greats, certainly from a British perspective in that regard. But, you know, I think it's simplified his life now that he's won a Grand Slam.
It's like the transition from angsty teenager to self-assured adult, isn't it, in tennis terms?
Yeah. Do you think I'll make that move one of these days? but actually, why are you laughing? As though you're wondering whether I might. Andy Murray. I'm just thinking though about that match that he played against Djokovic. I mean, I thought Murray had that won. I mean, I suppose we all did. He had five match points, but you know, it felt as though he'd got Djokovic again. You know, he was in his head. Perhaps he'd figured out the way to beat him. The early part of that match reminded me of the way Djokovic was beating Nadal time after time after time last year. And so where does that leave us, the fact that Djokovic turned that round? Is that huge credit to him? Is that a concern for Murray? What do you think?
Well, my answer to that is I don't really know. Obviously, huge credit to Djokovic. That goes without saying. I mean, I was doing BBM BlackBerry Messenger commentary for my parents, because they've just moved house and they're in a house without internet and TV and they couldn't watch, so they were like, can you send us updates? And I looked back through the comments that I'd been making.
How'd you do that with a 42 stroke rally?
Well, not ball by ball, shall we say, point/game by game. And I looked back through my comments and I was saying things like, oh, Murray's got him, you know, I'm not even, this isn't in doubt, you know, especially after he went, 5-3 up in the second set. I was saying that, you know, Murray seems to have all of the hard hitting and all of the aggression and shot making of Djokovic and the movement, etc. But he also is able to play shots that Djokovic can't. He also has that creative genius that Djokovic doesn't. And then suddenly he's made everything that I said turn to dust. And that either I was being a bit of a naive idiot, or Djokovic is made of something quite special, or both.
Well, I think he is made of something quite special. I don't think you're that naive, and you're not that much of an idiot. No, you're not an idiot at all. But I would say that it shows how precarious a lead can be in tennis, particularly at that level. Even when you've got match point, there's all you have to do is lose a match point, and you get that. The merest, smallest little momentum change. And as soon as you get a momentum change, a match can change. And I think that's what that proved to me, is that Djokovic is a player that will never give in. Even when he's match point down against Roger Federer at the US Open, he will go for a winner. And if he makes it, watch out. You know, he's still there. He's still got a chance. And that proved it.
And also, I think we keep harking back, don't we, to that the semi-final against Roger Federer at the US Open last year. But Djokovic isn't afraid of being match point down, is he? After that forehand return that he hit in that semi-final, match point down doesn't probably daunt him in the way that it used to. He just probably sees it as a bit of a challenge.
Absolutely right. No, absolutely right. So it was a cracking match. I think it bodes well for hopefully a similar kind of clash at the ATP World Tour Finals. I'm always a little wary of the fact that they're playing such grueling matches sort of a 3 weeks ahead of that tournament, because I don't think Djokovic has turned up at the O2 yet feeling fresh in the last 3 years. And I'd really love to see the top players come there this year feeling good.
That would make for a sensational tournament, wouldn't it? I mean, it's going to be full of intrigue whatever happens this year. I mean, touch wood, everybody's hoping. You know, we haven't heard anything to the contrary since Rafa said that the O2 World Tour Finals would be his first event back, so we have to assume that will be the case, in which case, you know, everyone's eyes are going to be firmly
on
him.
You really think Rafa will be back? I can't see it. I can't see him being back.
Well, we have, as I say, we haven't heard anything to the contrary. I agree. I think it seems unlikely. You'd have to think that why take the risk? Why take any form of risk at all when you could just have another couple of months of recovery and practice and come back strong for 2013.
Yeah. But well, it'll be interesting. I really am looking forward as ever to the Barclays ATP World Tour Finals, and it's something I'm lucky enough to go to for BBC Radio 5 Live, and I think it'll be a really good lineup this year. David Ferrer has just qualified as well. I think it really does add something that we have a British player there for the first time in the doubles in Johnny Murray, and good for him. What a great guy. And him and his partner, Freddie Nielsen, will both be there. I wonder if Heather Watson and Laura Robson might be at the WTA finals in years to come. They're ranked 50 and 52 respectively, as we mentioned. What we do know is that Heather Watson will be at the Royal Albert Hall as part of the Statoil Masters Tennis. That was just announced yesterday. She will be part of Ladies' Night, which takes place on Thursday the 6th of December. And Heather Watson will be partnering Tim Henman in mixed doubles at that event. And they'll be up against Anne Kyothavong and Mark Philippoussis. So that'll be really something, I think, for tennis fans in the United Kingdom to enjoy, for some of them perhaps to see Heather Watson for the first time. I mean, it'll be a great night, 6th of December, Thursday evening, and tickets are available now. So if you want to see Heather Watson, go to the Royal Albert Hall box office, go to the Statoil Masters Tennis website, and you'll be able to get some tickets there. We've been appealing, Catherine, for some questions tonight on Twitter, on our Twitter feed, at Tennis Podcast. And my word, have we received a few questions back. First of all, and I think we can admit to this based on the first 15-20 minutes of the podcast tonight, is that we haven't concentrated on the WTA top four, which we're often doing on the men's side. And Caroline Gallego, I think that's how I pronounce it, and I'm sure she'll put me right if I've got that wrong. So if I have, apologies. But she wants to know our thoughts on the top four. And I was looking down that list before we came on air, and it's Victoria Azarenka, who's very much the world number one at the moment. And she's just won two consecutive titles in Beijing and Linz last week, beating Maria Sharapova in Beijing, I think the fourth time this year. Serena Williams hasn't played a tournament since the US Open. which is a bit of a shame. But she feels like the world number one. Of course, beat Azarenka in that US Open final. And then Agnieszka Radwańska, who, of course, reached the Wimbledon final earlier this year, but still feels a bit like the distant number four to those other three. I don't know what you think.
Absolutely. And everybody is a distant number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 compared to Serena Williams, although the rankings don't bear it out. I'd like to hear somebody's argument to suggest that she isn't the best player in the world. And it is a shame that she doesn't, shame for the women's tour that she doesn't play more. I do think Victoria Azarenka is a genuine challenger to her, though. I think we've said it several times, but we think she's the real deal, don't we? And she'll be around for years to come. Maria Sharapova, I am full of admiration for just her attitude and her gutsiness, I suppose, and her determination to. I mean, you'd have absolutely forgiven her for turning her back on tennis, and especially after. I mean, not just due to all the many other distractions she's had going on in her life and opportunities, but watching that Olympic final when she got absolutely taken to the cleaners by Serena Williams. She just doesn't seem to get knocked back at all, does she? She just doesn't seem to be dented in any way. She just keeps
ploughing on, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's going to keep on doing her thing. And I'm full of admiration for that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, me too. A few other questions we've had in. Matthew Jones wanted to ask to us at Tennis Podcast, who we think's going to end up having the better career out of Heather Watson and Laura Robson. Obviously, we've covered that a little bit in the early part of the podcast, and I think we may have addressed it in previous episodes. I mean, Watson has certainly given me food for thought last week. I mean, she has for a while. I think she's the sort of player who, if you tell her that she can't, she goes out and proves you wrong. But I do believe that Laura Robson has the greater level of talent in terms of ability to just take on any top player in the world and out-hit them or out-serve them. And I think if she can stay injury-free and stay sufficiently focused and get told the right things, and I think in Jelka Krajn she has the sort of coach who can do those things, I think ultimately Robson will be the one who comes out with the Grand Slam titles. I've said here before that I think she will win one. I think she will be a top 10 player. I think Watson can be a top 20 player, and I think she can get into the second week of slams. I don't expect to see her win Grand Slams, but I would absolutely love it if she proved me wrong.
I think I more or less agree. I think Heather Watson has the potential to be a very consistent player. And I think she knows her game very well. And I think she uses it. She uses her game very well. But, I mean, it's undeniable that Laura Robson has weapons that Heather doesn't have, and if she can harness those weapons. I'm just looking at the WTA rankings at the moment, and it is a real mixture of the Laura Robson model of player, which is sort of Maria Sharapova, Petra Kvitova, and the Heather Watson type of player, which is, you know, Agnieszka Radwańska, Sara Errani, that kind of Marion Bartoli, that kind of thing. So I mean, it's not like one is, you know, I was sort of thinking, oh, is Heather's game a bit out of date, but actually not. You know, you look at Agnieszka Radwańska, number four in the world, she's not full of weapons and hard hitting, is she? That's not what
the point that David Eaglesham on Twitter has made, though, is that he doesn't believe a player of the ilk of Watson or a counterpuncher like Wozniacki, and although she got to world number one, doesn't feel that players like that, when they get to the sharp end of Grand Slams, have enough power to win big titles. You know, and I think if you go back to players like Martina Hingis many years ago, I think the question is, can a player like that, who's physically overpowered or, you know, outmatched?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Height-wise and so forth, can they find a way to beat a Serena Williams or to beat a Victoria Azarenka?
Well, the results would suggest that theory is correct. I mean, I think Justine Henin would have something to say about that, but she was a total anomaly, wasn't she, in that she had such perfection in her timing and technique. She was able to produce power and incredible shot making in spite of her size and stature. So Justine Henin aside, I'd say that probably is the case, that's probably an accurate assessment of where the women's game is at the moment, as opposed to, you know, in the late 90s when it was Martina Hingis and that kind of player that was reigning supreme.
Ben Howard on Twitter wants to know how long we think it will take Rafael Nadal to get back to his best once he declares himself fit enough to return. What do you think?
I don't think he'll come back until he is absolutely fully fit, fully ready and raring to go. So I think probably not that long.
So based on that, how long to get his form back?
Well, when are we assuming he's going to come back? Because if he does make a comeback at the World Tour Finals, he's got a week, hasn't he? And then it's the off-season, so that's that.
I think he probably does fancy that because I do think it mirrors the 2009 season when he sort of struggled for throughout the summer. Although he won the Olympic gold, and then he was it that year? I'm thinking the wrong year.
Of course, 09 was when he sat out.
09, he won the Australian Open, then he sat out of Wimbledon. He went through that summer, and eventually he sort of had a break, didn't he? And came back for the ATP World Tour Finals, and he was a shadow of himself. I mean, he didn't play well at all, but there was a sort of desire, there was a hunger about him at that event. I remember commentating on his matches, and you know, his eyes were popping out of his skull with the intensity of the way he was playing the points, and yet he lost all three singles matches. But I remember thinking at that time, just watch out, this guy is going to come out with steam coming out of his nostrils in Australia. And that is what happened. I do believe that he would probably like to do that in a best case scenario, just to get back into it. I suspect it's going to come too early. I think he'll end up coming out in Australia and doing the same thing. When do I think he'll get back to his best? I think when we get onto the clay, and it's not just because it's clay, but I think that time span works well. I think when we get to Monte Carlo in April, watch out, Rafael Nadal will be back.
Oh, I've no doubt that by the clay court season next year, we'll be speaking about him in the same terms we were in the clay court season this year. I think it could be a bit sooner than that. I think he could be a force to be reckoned with earlier on next season. I mean, it does all depend when he does actually come back. I mean, we will have to see. But as I say, I don't think he's going to make a tentative return. I think he's going to come out all guns blazing, you know, eyes popping out of his skull, as you say, desperate to claw back his position at the top.
How about we address our Goran Ivanišević interview part two? Because last week we heard from Goran, who talked about his early upbringing, his early career in which he played against the backdrop of the Balkans War and the devastation he experienced in those Wimbledon final losses to Pete Sampras in 1994 and 1998, and of course the earlier one against Andre Agassi in 1992. And there was the question mark, wasn't there? Will he ever do it? That was the question mark on everybody's lips, and Goran admitted it took him 3 years to feel happy again in his interview with Catherine Whittaker. Well, it wasn't 3 years since he was interviewed by Catherine, I should add. It was 3 years since he was defeated by Pete Sampras in that 1998 Wimbledon final, because, you know, he enjoyed the interview with Catherine, so he wasn't going to be depressed about that. But we talked to him about that 2001 run, a year really at Wimbledon that I think nobody will ever forget. I think it was one of my all-time favourite years. It was the year that Roger Federer announced himself on the world stage by beating Pete Sampras. It was the year that Tim Henman reached the semi-finals and became closer than he ever would do again and ever had been before of reaching a Wimbledon final in that three-day rain-interrupted semi-final against Goran. And really, the stars seemed to be aligning when Federer knocked out his nemesis, Goran's nemesis, Pete Sampras, in the fourth round. And we asked Goran if he thought at that moment this could be the year.
No, I didn't. I was not really, because I mean, that was like miles away. I didn't even think about Sampras. I didn't even think about anybody else. I just thought about myself, and I didn't care, because I felt it after second round I'm going to win the tournament. So I didn't care who was coming. Sampras, Federer, whoever, for me was just, but I could not say that, you know. When I beat Carlos in the second round, they gave me so much shit in the paper to Carlos. They said, how can you lose to, and I really played well, and I felt it, I played well, and every match I played better and better. So I didn't even care about Sampras losing.
And obviously you didn't, Henman took care of Federer that year for you, but I imagine you watched that match, Federer against Sampras. Did you know then how good Federer was?
I knew before. I said also to some people that when this guy is going to be number one, as soon as he changed something in his head, and he needs to win something big, and then he's going to be non-stopping. He's going to go just 300 kilometers on the highway without any stopping, and that happens, you know.
That one right.
When he won 3 when he beat Mark in the final. He went into the car and just never stopped. Just straight.
What do you remember about the night before your final with Rafter? Were you a bundle of nerves? Were you?
Actually, no. I was not. I was. That's why when I look at so many times that final, I started much better than him, because I was less nervous than him, because I just wanted to end this match. I wanted to start and end, and I could not wait anymore, and I started much better. I remember that I had the same dinner. I went to return my video around 9:45. Was queue, huge queue already waiting for the tickets, and I just was so happy when I entered the court, and that atmosphere, which never ever in the history of Wimbledon, because now we have a roof, going to happen. So it's just I was so happy to begin. I woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was already ready. I didn't sleep. I was ready at 6 in the morning, and ready to play.
When we think about it, David and I worry about what might have become of you if you hadn't won that Wimbledon final. When you think about it, do you have any idea where you'd be right now if that final had gone a different way?
I'll be here in Knocke.
Just a little bit less happy.
Just a little bit. Probably happy, but answering you the different kind of answer. That would be a big, huge disappointment. But I was not even came to my mind when I step on that court that is any possibility. Even the match was 9-7 and 50, you know, I didn't win like 2-2, you know. It was pretty close, and the fifth set was could go anyway. I didn't even think about that I can lose that match. I didn't even want to think that I can get another plate. I don't want any plates. I mean, it's a beautiful plate, but you don't want to have it.
Where do you keep the trophy then in your house?
My father has it in Split.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you not want to look at it every day?
Actually, now I was in Split. I look at these three plates. I look at the trophy. It's
so the plates are with the trophy. The plates aren't in a cupboard somewhere.
No, trophy is different.
In a special
place. Yeah, you don't want to mix that. This afternoon plates, the tea plates with the beautiful trophy. You know?
And you mentioned one of your superstitions there, which was going renting video every evening. Can you talk me through the other superstitions that you had that fortnight? Because I know there were a fair few.
Oh, there is waking up, same breakfast, same time. Oh, I had to pack my bag, Teletubbies. Bloody Teletubbies, but they were good, they were fun.
Do you ever watch the Teletubbies now,
Teletubbies,
just for nostalgia?
A couple of times I did, but I watched with my son a lot, he loved it. But they were fun, I was laughing a lot with this Teletubbies stuff, and parking at the same place, using the same bathroom, using the same shower, you know, it's so many stepping the lines, but once you get into it, if you forget one, you think you're going to lose. So it's better, it doesn't take too much time to do it, so it's better to do it.
And one last question. Your son, Emmanuel, he's 3, 4?
He's going to be 5 in October.
He is very keen on tennis, isn't he?
Yeah.
And your dad was very involved in your tennis career. Could you see yourself being a tennis dad?
I hope I don't have to be, to be honest. But he is keen. He told me the other day that he wants to play tennis because he loves to play tennis. And he really loves to play tennis. If I have to be, I'm going to be. But I'd rather him to play some other sport.
Trying to steer him in another direction.
Trick him. This is not good. Hypnotize him.
Hide his tennis rackets.
Just... maybe hire somebody to hypnotize him during his sleeves. Tennis is bad.
But don't you feel like tennis has given you so much joy and happiness?
It is. If I can't tell him what to do, I'm going to help him, whatever sport, whatever, even if he wants to be, I don't know, whatever, mathematicians, whoever, whatever. But he loves sport. He's not bad in that. And... but he's too young to see what it's going to be. He can change his mind 50 times. But tennis gave me everything. Tennis gave me my friends, my life, my everything what I have. And I would not change tennis for anything in my life. If I have to choose again, I will choose tennis again. So if he wants to take tennis, it's not easy job, easy trip, easy whatever. It's going to be a lot of ups and downs, but... at least I can tell him, help him with that, you know. But if I will coach him, that is a good question. I don't think so, because probably I will kill him after 2 weeks. I will hang him on the tree somewhere. So I so I will find him a coach.
Maybe Bob Bradley.
I don't think Bob wants to deal with it. He will kill me and him. So, somebody. But we see, still time.
Emmanuel Ivanisevic. Catherine, could it happen? Could we have another member of the Ivanisevic family as a top tennis player? What do you think?
I tell you what, if there's anybody out there that likes a bit of a long-range gamble... If you could get a bookie to give you a 10,000-to-1 on Emmanuel Ivanisevic being a Grand Slam champion one day, I'd take it, because he's the most talented toddler I have ever seen, and that is genuinely without any encouragement from Goran. You know, Goran says he almost actively discourages him from playing tennis. He's never given him any coaching, and honestly, the kid is something to behold. So watch this space. Wow. You might have to be watching for quite a long time, but
wow, goodness me. Well, that interview, of course, the second part of that interview touched on Goran Ivanišević and his Wimbledon triumph, and it's probably one of the ultimate "where were you when" questions in tennis. You know, where were you, Catherine, when Goran Ivanišević won that Wimbledon title, and how were you feeling? We know who you were supporting. You were supporting Pat Rafter, but
all right. But prepare to feel old, then. Prepare to feel old. I was in my secondary school computer room, watching with a group of schoolmates on a tiny little TV, supporting, as we know, Pat Rafter. Everybody else in the room was supporting Goran, and I hated them for it. And it was quite a memory. I only remember one person. I wasn't even particularly friends with the people in the room with me at the time, but at the end of it, I felt like we were all friends because it was such an experience. And in another world, I might have been there, because I remember I was 15 at the time, so I was too young to just sort of pitch up on my own and queue. But I remember when it was announced that it was going to be a Monday final, I sort of looked at my dad and said, "Come on," and he called his work, or he looked into whether he would possibly be able to take the day off. But alas, it was not to be. So thank you very much, Bechtel, the company my dad worked for at the time. I wasn't there.
Oh well, not so. I wasn't there either. It was the year before I joined the Five Live tennis team, so I didn't get the chance to be there either. But I was in a tournament in Gstaad in Switzerland at the time, because that, you know, the travelling circus nature of the tennis tour means that just as one tournament is ending, we're all pitching up at the next one, and it's alarming to be at a tournament like a Grand Slam, where you have an absolutely packed locker room and player lounge for the best part of 4 or 5 days, and gradually, as the 2 weeks go on, the amount of people in those areas gets smaller and smaller. And when we got to the final weekend of a slam, suddenly there's probably, what, you know, three or four or five players left in total. There's obviously the finalists, there's the doubles finalists, and a few coaches knocking around, and that's about it. And there we were in Gstaad in Switzerland, in this beautiful tournament, crammed into the player lounge where the tournament is yet to start, and you've got all 32 main singles draw players, you've got all the doubles players, you've got all the coaches, all the tour managers. I was in there as well as the communications manager of the ATP at the time, and you've got players like Ivan Ljubicic, who's Goran's compatriot, literally looking through his fingers and sobbing his heart out as the final few points are played out. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Him and his wife were sitting there absolutely in floods of tears. The match hadn't even finished yet. You'd got Jeff Tarango, who's giving a sort of commentary on every single point to the rest of the room, and telling Goran where he'd got to serve. And because I think a good amount of them, the majority, as popular as Pat Rafter is and was, the majority knew what this meant to Goran. And we said last week, nobody has a bad word to say about Goran within tennis. And the majority of that room were in Goran's camp, and it was an incredibly emotional moment, not just for anybody who was in that stadium, but for the rest of the world watching. I strongly believe that. I asked the people on Twitter who follow us at Tennis Podcast just before we came on for some of their memories, and somebody with the wonderful handle of Babbling Brat has told me that she experienced tears of joy. We've also had a message from Swedish Meatball 78, who said that he queued all morning to get in, and it was one of the best moments he can ever remember because of the atmosphere. And I think that's one thing Goran touched on, isn't it? I've never seen an atmosphere at a tennis match like that before or since, because everybody was just allowed to get in you know, on the day, and it was Croatian flags everywhere, it was Australian flags everywhere, chanting. It was like a football crowd, and you know, I wish we had more of that. It was absolutely unbelievable.
It was special, wasn't it? And it's with some, it's almost with regret that Goran talks about the roof, because he knows that that'll never happen again. And that is, you know, obviously 99% of the time the roof is a positive thing, but it is a shame that we'll never have an occasion like that again at Wimbledon. But
that's right.
I suppose it makes it all the more special.
It did make it more special. We did have one dissenting voice from Mark Black, who said that Goran's behaviour was a disgrace and I was gutted for Rafter. And basically what he's getting at is the way that Goran had one of his customary meltdowns in the fifth set and kicked the net and started swearing a bit and all that kind of thing. But, you know, this is Goran Ivanišević, isn't it? And he does get a bit irate sometimes, and it was the biggest day of his life. I think we can forgive that, can't we?
Yeah, sorry, we are a bit biased, aren't we? And we see incidents like that through the lens of people who sort of know him and love him for all of his feistiness and everything like that. But I suppose strictly, you know, that's not technically sportsmanlike conduct, isn't it? So some people are sticklers for that. So.
Yes, well, fair play, Mark. You have every right to your opinion, but I don't agree with you. Anyway, that's Goran Ivanišević, who will never be forgotten for the way he won Wimbledon in 2001. And we love seeing him on the Champions Tour. We get to work with him, which is a real pleasure. And he will be at the Statoil Masters Tennis himself in London at the Royal Albert Hall from the 5th to the 9th of December. Come and watch him play along with John McEnroe and Tim Henman and Pat Cash and all of the other great characters from the past. They'll all be there, and it'll be a cracking few days. That's it from us, I think, for now, isn't it, Catherine? Or do we have anything else to cover just before we go on the tennis podcast?
I was going to suggest we give a quick nod to Roger Federer's 300th week at World Number One.
That's a bit remiss of me not to acknowledge Roger Federer having become the most prolific World Number One in history.
No, yeah, I mean, it literally doesn't happen every week. It literally can only happen every 300th week. So yeah, absolutely
just
incredible.
Years at number one.
I mean, are there enough superlatives to give sufficient credit to that achievement? I'm not sure there are.
No, well, I think it's one of the records you wonder whether it'll ever be broken. I mean, I know they're good mates, and I know that Sampras has been only kind in his words about Roger Federer over the years. But imagine if you'd put the years in that he had, and he'd amassed the records that he had, and he'd finally broken Roy Emerson's Grand Slam record, and he'd finally broken Ivan Lendl's weeks at number one record. And, you know, you might think you'd get a few years to enjoy it before some Swiss upstart comes along and breaks them all, wouldn't you?
Has Sampras got any records left now? I'm just racking my brain.
He has one left that I know when he set it, he thought would never be broken. And I suspect he may well be right. And it was the years, I think years in a row, that he was number one in the world at the end of the year. And I think it was, I can't remember whether it was 5 or 6 years in a row that he did it. And I remember the final year that he did it was, I think, 1998. And I remember the stress on his face as he managed to do it. And, of course, Roger Federer hasn't been able to do that, partly because of Rafael Nadal getting in the way, of course, his nemesis. But I wonder whether any player will ever break that record. I'm sure Pete's clinging on to that one.
Doesn't he? Let's let him have that one. Roger, just let him have it.
Yeah,
it's supposed to be his friends, for God's sake. Just let him have one.
Absolutely. Well, it's been enjoyable as always, Catherine. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to episode 16 of the Tennis Podcast, and we'll be back next week with more. Speak to you then. So Goran won it. Thank goodness for that. He knew almost instantly that he could now retire happily and settle down for an easy life supporting West Bromwich Albion. Well, that's what I told him anyway. We'll be back next week with more tennis chat and another big interview as we count down to the ATP World Tour Finals and the Statoil Masters Tennis.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.